This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
What's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety. Today we're talking about lone working, but it's kind of a different perspective around a different industry that I probably never would have thought of until I was kind of in it or speaking about it. But we're kind of talking, I suppose, around like the definition or at least where our thoughts go when we mention lone worker. It's kind of changing, and lone worker is actually becoming a bit of a risk that's kind of hard to manage now in certain spaces, which maybe we didn't really think about before. You want to find out some more about it? We'll jump in the intro and then I'll tell you some more about it and we can get into today's episode. Let's go.
The problem in safety isn't deviation, it's complexity.
Health and safety has gone mad.
Health and safety is trying to unpick having gone mad in the past.
There's no one solution and one problem. The problem is that we are looking for one solution.
Does the structure of the team allow them to flourish?
Feel safe enough to be uncomfortable.
The environment defines our behaviors.
People aren't the problem, they're the solution.
Rebranding Safety, crushing a stereotype. Brought to you by Risk Blue.
What's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety. Rebranding Safety is a YouTube channel and podcast doing exactly what it says on the tin. So if you're new here, hit subscribe, hit the bell, hit all of those magical algorithm buttony thingamajigs. My name's James McPherson from the company Risk Fluent LTD, which is the health, safety and culture consultancy that sits behind Rebranding Safety. Rebranding Safety is essentially our purpose as an organization. We really do want to make safety kind of help go into that next evolution, change its perception and so on. And you are all part of this journey. So thank you very much for listening in. If you're a loyal listener or a new listener, it doesn't matter. You're all welcome here. Even if you're a pained listener, even if you're like, I fucking hate that James guy, but somebody said this episode was really good, so I'm just going to have to fucking listen to it. Maybe I'll turn it down when James talks. I'd like to know if there was actually anyone like that. Anyway, today we're talking to a lovely lady over in Canada who kind of went from a non-safety related industry and then went on a really interesting journey to create a piece of tech that supports lone workers. You might all be thinking, oh, we've spoken to lone worker apps before and things like that, and there is many of them, and you're right, there is. It was an interesting conversation though, because they were coming at it from what industries are we talking to, or more importantly, what industries actually are we not talking to that we should be? And essentially, that's what we spoke about today. So I won't tell you any more because I don't want to spoil it. Let's jump into the episode and then Cerise will introduce herself. Let's get in to the episode. There we go. Cerise, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming on. So we're going to talk about lone working and stuff today and the work that you guys are doing at Solus Gadget. But first, do you want to give us a bit of an introduction into yourself?
For sure. Well, first of all, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. This is definitely a treat for sure. My name is Cerise Landers, and I'm the founder and CEO of Solus Guard. And what we do is we help to keep lone workers safe. And I would describe myself as an accidental entrepreneur. This isn't something that I had planned in my life, but here we are today.
And you are based out of Canada.
Correct. Yes.
So have you always lived in Canada?
I have always lived in Canada. Always in my home province of Saskatchewan. I've been many places, but I've always lived there. Yeah. And which is fine right now, but in the winter, I wonder why I'm there.
It's always part of the world. I think I'll have to go one day. Like it looks beautiful. It sounds amazing. Everyone's really nice. And I don't know, is that a cliche? Is that real? Is everyone genuinely really nice in Canada? Or?
You know, for the most part we are, particularly to tourists and strangers, like to each other, maybe not so much, but we're generally an agreeable sort of people.
Yeah. Just completely going off piece. Does the kind of like cliche of like Canadians all apologize even when they're in the right, does that get annoying or is that like?
It does get annoying. And for the most part, people are like that. Now I'm not like that personally. So it does really bother me because I don't get it. So, but yeah, so there's a lot of super friendly people that feel the need to apologize for everything, which I don't get myself. But Teach us all.
I don't think any country can not have a stereotype that annoys them. So that's good. Okay, we didn't want to talk about Canada, that's for sure.
There are assholes here too, though, so for sure.
Oh, that's good. That's good to know. That's good to know. Give me kind of a bit of a backstory of you and kind of how you came to be the accidental entrepreneur that you say.
Yeah, I spent all my career in financial services industry working for financial planning, banking, all of that sort of fun stuff, and was, you know, had a pretty good career in it. But my parents became ill, and that really changed the narrative for me. And I was looking for a way to keep them safe, and all I could find was medical alert devices. So I don't know if you have them there, but we have this terrible commercial from, I don't know, the 80s, "Help, I've fallen and can't get up." It's horrifying. Anyways, those alert devices. And so my dad wouldn't wear anything like that. I needed to find something different. Had an idea of how I could create something different and thought, how hard could it be? Well, spoiler alert, it's really, really hard, but I didn't know it at the time. So I started building my first company, which was these medical alert devices or personal safety devices for seniors, but a lot more modern and look better, et cetera. So that's kind of how I got into it. Well, then pretty soon it just overtook everything. And I did what any reasonable person would do. I quit my high paying job and my salary and my pension and benefits. And I let all that go to start a tech company. So that was my first company. And then out of there, what ended up happening is we just had all sorts of companies and government organizations looking for ways to keep their employees safe. And from Aura, which was the first company, came Solus Guard, which is the lone worker safety company.
Wow. So is Aura still going, the one that's more targeted in the senior community? Or
yeah, it is still going. We've been dealt, like many organizations, many companies across the world and many tech companies, a couple blows as it relates to the global chip shortage and supply chain issues and whatnot. So Aura has been a bit on pause over this last year or so. Well, we've been focusing on Solus Guard for now, but the idea is to come back to it and when we're ready and we have the inventory for Aura to keep that going as well.
Because it's interesting, just, I know we didn't come on to talk about that, but it is interesting that what drove you to do that. And in my safety career, I've worked in the care sector, and the majority of the stuff for the care sector, it is a bit garish and like ugly and just like it screams like I'm old now, doesn't it? Like, so it's interesting that something I'd observed, like, oh God, I don't think my grandma would want that. Like, my grandma's always been very quite prim and proper. And I just think, God, she'd never have some of that stuff in her house. And interesting that the same thing has driven you to be where you are now. That's interesting.
It's horrifying. Some of that stuff, they look like garage door openers. That's what they look like. And we say to older adults, you know, put this on, smile and be happy and pretend that you love it. But you're absolutely right. It's this big sign on their body that says, I'm old and I'm frail and take care of me. And they hate it. And then we wonder why they don't wear it. And when they need it, it's on the bedside table and they can't reach it because nobody wants to wear that. It's horrifying. Yeah. So that was the first thing that we addressed. We actually took the technology, put it into jewelry, beautiful jewelry, or discreet wearables that nobody could tell what it was, just addressing that issue to make it actually wearable. So people wore it and used it and stayed safe was, you know, a must do. And it's funny how design seems to be the last thing when it comes to older adults, which is not fair because there are a lot of women that in particular that are very prideful and men too. They're just, it's, I don't know why we neglect them in that process.
And interestingly, I would say that design and maybe aesthetics is equally a latter consideration in safety as well. So when you were talking, so as you said, in that kind of journey, and I appreciate I'm skipping around all over the place, but in that kind of journey, you then started getting interest from companies to say, could you do this for my employees? So what were you finding? Was it that you didn't have anything, or was it that they liked the ethos and what you guys were doing in that sector, or was it maybe a bit of both?
Well, you know, the problems that we solved in the senior side of things, one was aesthetics for sure. And it does actually matter with a lot of the industries that we're working with. It maybe doesn't matter if you're oil and gas or construction, but it matters if you're a professional, that you've got something really discreet. So that mattered. It mattered that it paired with a smartphone and some of the technology that we have around that. That mattered. It mattered that it was customizable or that it had a backup called emergency. So the fundamental pieces that we had made for older adults directly translated over to industry anyways. So the organizations that were reaching out to us saying, yes, this, exactly this, but over here with us. And then as we worked with them, they said, now, in addition to that, we need more. We need it to be more complex. We need check-in software. We need satellite. We need all these other things. But the core functionality of our panic buttons essentially translated into solving a need on the industry side.
Nice. Did you find that was the aesthetics conversation, you kind of touched on it. It was very much depending on industry. So you weren't we weren't bothered about it in oil and gas, but maybe in the more professional type side, they were bothered about it. Was that quite a strong dominant conversation? Or?
Yes, absolutely. I remember, you know, having a conversation with, so here in Canada, all the parole officers across the country use our product. And they said, you know, these are individuals who in Canada, they don't wear guns. They don't wear, you know, a full set of gear. They're dressed like professional people and they go out and they meet with the parolees. And they said, you know, there's all sorts of people, all sorts of sizes, women and men wearing professional clothing and having this big thing on them, which was cumbersome to wear. Difficult, clunky, but also obvious to the parolee. As to what it is. For all of these reasons, it just wasn't safe.
Yeah. Because that's interesting. Again, when I worked in the it was kind of the care sector, but we also had, I had several properties within my region that was like ex-offender type properties. So similar type of environment. And we had these quite big, like lanyardy type things that were just like, you know, panic button, like it looked like a big joke button on there. You know, I ended up getting a bit more subtle ones later on, but ultimately the customers in the building knew very much what they were. They weren't subtle. They knew what they were. Some of the staff found that they didn't like to wear them because it distracted from a conversation in that, why are you wearing that? You don't trust me. Is that why you're wearing that? And it didn't help the conversation. So interestingly, the kind of knock-on effects as to your point, like knock-on effects of the how things look. And that comes back to, I find it fascinating why I'm kind of doubling down on this. I find it fascinating that doubles back to really your original intent with the first problem that you were trying to solve is how does this look and what message does that communicate out?
Absolutely. Well, it sets a tone for sure. You know, if you're going to go into a meeting that's already, you know, high stress or high stakes, you're going into this and the person across from you is saying, oh, so this is how it's going to be. You know, already those tension levels start to rise. And so if you can eliminate that without eliminating their ability to call for help, obviously you need them to stay safe. So it's a saw off. So yeah, the aesthetics actually do matter, as does simplicity. I found that, you know, we built our technology so that somebody who's 90 years old, and we had 90-year-olds using our tech because you need a smartphone, you need a few things like that. So it needed to be extremely simple and intuitive. And what we found that also translated to industry, because there's all sorts of people with different levels of tech savviness and comfort level with technology. And also they're trying to do their job. They're not focusing on tech. So if we created something that was really, really simple to use and manage, then they were more likely to use it. So I do find it quite interesting that all these fundamental factors that we built for a 90-year-old translates into something for basic industry. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's actually fascinating. When we spoke before, we didn't really touch on that, and that is quite fascinating. That just even from like a entrepreneurial point of view, that kind of following the journey of that problem, and you've solved that problem and got to a point where you're like, oh, this is actually working quite well, and we're doing something really cool here, and then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, you've got the same problem, but from a different perspective, causing different potential outcomes, which I find that's fascinating. That really is. You've touched on a couple of interesting industries, and I want to really get into that because I find this fascinating, what we want to talk about today. But typically, the kind of first kind of interest that you were getting with this, was it typically those oil and gas? So sectors that we might all think about when we talk about lone working, was that the first interest that you were getting when you started moving over to the industry type things? Would it those typical kind of trade engineering based environments, or you talked about like the care sectors, the parole sector, sorry, for example, was that an early on?
Right out of the gates, it was a mix. And I think that also caused some confusion for us because we were trying to figure out where do we fit. And on like our very first paying customer was a real estate agent. And so I don't know if you call them real estate agents as well. They sell homes. So the real estate agent. So that was our very first customer. And we had a number of those. And then the next one that we had was government agencies for highways and some of the more traditional companies. So then we're confused. We're like, okay, well, there's this very blue collar type industry. And then over here, this is very white collar industry. And so trying to figure out, you know, being an early stage startup, and where is your ideal customer profile or ICP, and who should we focus on, and who do we market to? And it was a little schizophrenic because there was kind of all of these different areas. And lone worker, if you were to look it up, I bet what always comes up is the blue collar, the oil and gas, and the, you know, that construction and utilities, that sort of a thing, of which we do have customers in that space. But what was really growing for us was this completely different industry that we hadn't anticipated. This industry that involved everything from nurses and teachers and politicians and this whole other group that I think just have it hasn't been catered to in any way or hasn't been serviced in any way.
Because when we first kind of talking, that was the interest thing, because even piqued my kind of, oh yeah, I've actually never thought of some of these professions. Like, for example, you touched on kind of politics, for example, which is becoming around the world. Sorry, just to quickly answer your question, that we call them estate agents. So we get rid of the real, but we still call them estate agents. So yeah, didn't even think about politicians, you know, and the MPs in my town and the next town, they're just like, you could bump into them in the pub, like, which is probably not a good thing, like, but in a way they are an employee of, I don't know, the government, I suppose, a local council. I'm not really sure how it works around here, but and they are very much like, you don't see them walking around with, like, you know, close protection officers or anything like that, or security. So I never thought of that, of politicians actually at all. I think you would expect the prime minister and maybe the cabinet, you know, like his top six people to be like, yeah, okay, fair enough. They're a big target. But like we had an MP, it was before COVID. So it must be like, must've been about a fair few years ago now. But the lady, I can't remember her name, I think it was Jo something, who got stabbed, and she was an MP. She got stabbed, and I believe it was during work. So it well and truly is like a huge problem, and they well and truly are lone workers, like walking around doing a bit. They might pop into somewhere where there is a group, but ultimately they do work on their own. And I would have never have put two and two together. And maybe it's because I've not worked in that industry, but when you, I mean, do you work in the politics space, or is that just something you're aware of?
I don't work in that space, but definitely aware of it. And the incidences are against politicians are absolutely rising. There's something you just said a minute ago that you said while she was at work. What I find though with politicians is that they're sort of like celebrities in the fact that they're always in the eye of the public. They're always at work. They sort of lose their identity as an individual, and they become this, as you said, they're the MP, they're the mayor, they're the whatever they are. They're no longer themselves. They don't have the luxury like we do of being at work or not at work. They're always perceived by the public as being at work, which means that no matter where they are, what they're doing, whether they're at work or not, the public perceives them that way. And that's, I think, part and parcel of the problem is that the public or individual people no longer see them as humans, or no longer see them as an individual who's a mother or a husband or a dad or a mom. They just see them as this persona, and creates a level of anonymity. And so if they're not happy with them, it's almost like it's okay if I take it to the next level. And we see vitriol in social media all the time directed against politicians, which is really unfortunate, because there is this cloak of anonymity as it relates to social media. But somehow it has broken a barrier where even in person, in real life, it's still this, these attacks keep coming, and the frequency is increasing and the level of severity is increasing. And now people are getting really hurt and killed on the job. On the job, they're doing a job, but somehow people don't see it that way.
Yeah. It's such an interesting point, is it? Like you say, like when are they not on the job? So they become, to your point, like these characters, don't they?
Yes.
They never stop. And I would agree with that. I don't particularly like the MPs that represent my area or the next area along, like, don't really like either of them. It wasn't a lady. There was something that happened with a lady, but Jo Cox, she was a Labour Party. She was, I believe she died after being shot and stabbed. And then Sir David Amess, he was stabbed as well, I believe. So I think we've had two cases of it in the UK. I'm showing my lack of keeping up with modern news. I think we've had quite a couple of cases of it in the UK. And I think interesting that the conversations that politics get involved are more and more volatile, aren't they? And when you've got social media tends to become this echo chamber, which I do think social media is a good thing. I'm definitely not against social media, but I think it's blurred the lines where people have gone. Mm-hmm. People have gone, I can say things. It's kind of like, well, if I can say this and this is really bad on social media and get away with it, what's the difference for me chucking an egg at the politician? So, and I threw an egg and that wasn't that bad. Nothing happened. So what's the difference? And it kind of just quite quickly escalates. I mean, I think it was Gordon Brown back in the day got some pie chucked on his head or something like that. And we might all laugh at that, but is that like the next natural evolution, isn't it? Of like, yeah, it's quite funny maybe in a different context, but actually it's violence.
Yes, it is violence. And this escalation and this rising, I don't know even how to articulate it, but it just seems to be getting worse and worse with no checks and balances to say, okay, that's enough. And you see that in so many industries, like in particular, I think what COVID has done, it obviously has raised the temperature and caused stress and anxiety. I get that. But if you look at healthcare workers and how at the beginning of the pandemic, we were, you know, banging our pots and pans and, you know, thankful and all of this was so great. And now there are so many conspiracy theorists out there and so many people who are against the healthcare workers and the threats and the violence that happens against a nurse. Like, who would have thought a nurse would be, you know, at risk, or a teacher or a social worker, all of these positions, which we once thought were just jobs that people went and did, that they weren't at risk. Now, all of a sudden, they're at risk for just doing their job. It feels somewhat shocking and sad to me.
And it is kind of, as an organization, it's interesting because I'm having this conversation with another guest that's going to come on the podcast about safety professionals considering kind of like the political, economical kind of situation of society and how that could impact your work. And ultimately, like, so if we take Brexit, for example, which was a phenomenally sensitive topic over here, you know, we're not allowed to talk about it in our house. So if family comes round, there's like me and my wife on one side, and then there's like the rest of the family on the other side. And me and my mother-in-law basically are not allowed to talk about it because we just disagree. And it got tense, like it got really tense. But at the end of the day, we're all still family. I'm not going to jump over the table and start punching my mother-in-law. She might punch me, but ultimately there are some times that people can take these conversations a lot more seriously, and they can start to have really personal connections and impact, can't they? So if we were to take a political decision during COVID, for example, if we were to take the recent kind of, I don't know, scandal, you might want to call it, that we've had of Boris Johnson and his political party having, you know, a piss up during COVID, it could be that you've not been able to say goodbye to a loved one when they passed away, or meet your new grandchild or whatever, be with your partner when they give birth or whatever. That's a phenomenally sensitive and emotional topic. And if you found out your local politician voted in one way or was involved in that piss up and they were there, and then you walk past them on the street on a bad day, like the flipping of that switch is close, isn't it? So from a company perspective, it's considering those wider political, social, economical, cultural type things that could potentially impact your work, being like, actually, I can see how my local MP votes, and I think that's disgusting, and I could get really angry about that. How close am I to taking that over to the next level of it being like a dangerous conversation? So now, as a safety professional, and then yourselves coming at this from a kind of technical solutions provider, we've really got to start considering a much wider broad of risks and influences for managing the safety of these people.
Absolutely. Because I think before it was always the true lone worker. So who is the person who works alone that has environmental risks? That's what we thought of, right? And that's why we thought of utilities and oil and gas and construction, the blue collar type roles, because that's who they were. That's what they did. And we thought that was the only risks to being a worker that you had to face. Well, now all of that is kind of blurred because no longer are you necessarily alone even. So it's not lone, because you could be in a crowd if you think about a reporter or a politician or something like that. Or you could be in a community if you're home care worker, mental health and addictions worker, et cetera. So that lone aspect of it is not even the case anymore. And environmental, it's people. And so who we consider to be at risk has changed considerably, unfortunately, over time. And it just seems to be ramping up now. So I think that's the challenge that organizations face, is they can no longer say, who's our lone worker? And we need to put something in place. Now they need to say, who do we have that's at risk, and what can we do to keep them safe?
Mm. It is that kind of it's that flip side. I think for so long in safety we've spoke about, okay, how do we eliminate the risk and blah blah blah, and we do all of that kind of pre front end loading kind of risk management. I find a lot of the time with our clients when we say, okay, so what happens when this goes wrong? Like, how do you deal with that? So if I take a really technical type example, being like work at height, so really basics, health and safety, right? So often we go, okay, what's your rescue plan? What do you mean, what's the rescue plan? Like, no one's ever fell out of the cab, or no one's ever come off the roof, or we've got full edge protection, or they're harnessed. Like, yeah, but you need to think about, if something did go wrong, how are you going to rescue them? Because they're at height, they're all the way over there. And the door just opened, so I was wondering what that was. You know, they're all the way over there at the top of this spiral or whatever. What happens if it goes wrong? I find it's quite a rarity for people to have that conversation. So if you just flip it on your head and start thinking about a journalist, which I would have always put in the bracket of a very low risk job, unless they were like some kind of cool investigative journalist or whatever, you might put them in quite a low risk job. But ultimately, what could go wrong? And if it does go wrong, how can we respond to that? That's when I think we start talking about how quickly can we react? How quickly can we get there? You know, those panic type, lone worker type devices, which is where it starts to get interesting.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Make it clear that the use of computer vision is because that you want to learn about patterns of behavior in parts of workplace to improve the work environment. Then you will not use it as a disciplinary tool unless there are exceptional circumstances. Consult employee reps. Give them a distraction of what CV will do, CV being computer vision, as well as reassuring them. They will have great ideas about how it can be used to protect people. They're just two of the rules in the white paper that Protex AI have done for building trust within the workplace when we're using computer vision AI. So computer vision is like the AI tech that goes onto your CCTV that Protex AI do. And one of the biggest issues that we've got is that we've just got a culture of where we think, not just as a company or you, like, just I think everyone, a majority of people have a culture where you think you're only doing this to spy on me. And that's the problem when we've got predominantly a lot of these AI type data building type tech innovations. And that was one of the things that stood out when we spoke to Protex AI. We had quite a lot of these computer vision people come to us at Rebounding Safety being like, oh, can we talk about, you know, talking to your audience and stuff like that. And one of the first things we would try and get out of them is like, how are you using this? And the second we got a hint of like, you're using it to punish the worker, we didn't want it. It was just being used as another stick to beat the worker. And the thing that stood out with Protex is that they didn't want that to happen. And they've kind of put that, this kind of whole ethos into a white paper, which is a great piece of information. It's free of charge. You can download it from the website. It's called AI's Role in Promoting a Proactive Safety Culture, all about kind of building that data and becoming more proactive. But one of the first things we need to do is increase trust. That's why I really liked their kind of list of rules essentially to build trust. Like, this is how we're going to use it, and this is that framework we're going to operate within. So you can find the link in the description below for that white paper. It's not massive, it's a relatively easy read. It's not horrendous like academic type paper. It's an easy read. It's broken down into nice chunks, and there's a lot of valuable information in there, along with a little bit of a bonus as a kind of little introduction into safety culture. So if you weren't sure as to where the word or phrase safety culture came from, it's in that paper as well. Go to the link in the description and download your paper now.
But you do raise a really good point. I think in the safety industry, we are trained to think about those particular risks, like you said, falling from height, those environmental risks. We all know about that. We are taught about that right from the get-go. These are the types of risks to look at. And I think a lot of organizations are caught off guard when something happens because they don't expect that their reporter is going to get attacked. Although now, unfortunately, there's been so many examples of that happening, in particular with women, that I think they're starting to think about it. But exactly that. First of all, is just being aware, be open to the thought that something could happen in an industry that maybe it never did happen before, and thinking about what, if that does happen, what is the ideal outcome? What is the best way to address that? And as you said, like getting help, getting notification, responding in some way, all of these things. So there's the that's very reactive, but there's also some proactive technologies out there as well. So it's a bit of a blend, some proactive, some reactive, but no matter what, just not leaving somebody stranded or leaving them with a way, not with a way out.
Mm. Yeah. And I do find it fascinating that those kind of, it's asking that question, coming back to what we were speaking about earlier, like what is society starting to find more acceptable to push the lines on? Like, so if I think about in a film, you might watch a film, right, and see us, you know, the press really hounding this like celebrity in the film, and the celebrity kind of like maybe whacks the journo or whatever. Yeah, actually, just saying the word journo makes me think about it, like from there's like a football violence film that's quite popular in England called Green Street, right? And there's this whole thing about how they hate journalism, so we're starting to betray this, like maybe acceptance, this social permission to actually go, actually, yeah, journalism, it's a dirty profession. They're the pond scum of like media. It's okay for us to treat them like shit because they treat some celebrities like shit. And then on the flip side, if I always find it interesting when I'm sitting in the living room, maybe talking to family or whatever, and they're like, oh, it's so horrible that journalists can just treat celebrities like this. And okay, cool, all right, yeah, fair enough. But if you're consuming that media, then you're creating the demand that's having the knock-on effect, which then has a knock-on effect that the journalist is pissing off the celebrity, then finds it acceptable. So you start to put all this stuff together, and that, again, coming back to the original kind of point, is it is wider societal demands and conversations and characters and so on is creating a situation that as a business, you ultimately would probably never attach to being a contributing factor to an incident, but actually it is.
Yes. Yeah, it is amazing. It's not a simple problem. It's not a simple solution. It is very much culture, society, that whole integration of what's acceptable and what isn't. And yeah, the blurred lines that you talked about previously, it's really interesting. And I don't necessarily see a simple way out of this either. It'll be interesting to see which direction it goes, though.
And it is as the I don't know whether it just feels it or whether it actually is, but it just genuinely feel like the world is just getting more angry.
Yeah, absolutely. I like I said before, I think with the pandemic, temperatures started to rise. And I mean that, you know, obviously from a figurative way, unfortunately literal as well, but a figurative way in terms of how people were reacting and responding to one another, what was acceptable language and behavior. And it was largely in social media, but I think that it is coming out to the forefront. We're all being let out, if you will, and back to what was pre-pandemic. And yet some of the social norms I think that we had before aren't in check anymore somehow. I'm not really sure why or how that is, but and maybe I'm being a little bit naive or Pollyanna, and maybe it was rising before that. And this is just coming to a head now. I'm not really sure. It just seems that the incidents and rates of violence against all these different industries is shocking. And maybe it's also because we're so close to the United States, where it is really at a boiling point, where you see, you know, whole classrooms being shot up and people being killed. It's really extreme there. And that could be part of it as well.
Mm. Yeah. I was just thinking, like, as you were kind of talking, like where, if I was, I don't know, where is the kind of line? So if I was thinking, like, you might say a football player. Yeah. Fair enough. Investment. Like, you know, we already know that there's violence within football, particularly within the UK. It's a big problem for us. So should we give our football players? Yep. Okay. Let's give our football players that. Like, but what level of football players? Like, where does it become? Okay. Yeah. Like, are we talking Premiership? Probably an easy win. Yeah, Premiership, loads of money. What about Championship? I know nothing about football, so I have no idea whether this. So my thought track was like, okay, if we go Premiership in football would make sense. Should we do the same with rugby? So I'm a massive rugby fan. Now, I've stood next to most of the Premiership rugby players quite a lot of them, and they're bloody huge. You'd never probably pick on any of them. Even small ones, you'd be probably scared of. They probably don't need a lone worker device because I'll be more worried for the person that picks on them, if I'm honest. But like, just to take it as a perspective of like, if I go and watch a rugby game, it's quite likely I will see those players and those coaches. Like, there's less of a barrier. It's not a completely separate world. Whereas if I go and watch football, for example, I don't think it's quite possible that I'll come across one of the players. Whereas in rugby, it is really quite easy. If you go to Wimbledon, for example, in the tennis in England, you can literally just stand in a crowd and one of the big names of tennis will just walk straight through. Like, it's kind of like you couldn't, I don't know, it would feel for me kind of disproportionate if you tried to put it on, say, like tennis, where there's never been really any violence in the industry or in that sport. But like, to your point, is where is the line? Like, do we wait until somebody gets smacked or somebody gets her or whatever?
Well, I think as it relates to more of the celebrity, whether that's a sports celebrity or whether that's, film celebrity or something like that, or even some of the large, very large Fortune 100, Fortune 500 CEOs, exact that sort of a thing. When it comes to those individual people, they actually most likely already have their own security detail. Of which they are doing business with a company like mine. We do work with organizations like that. So they're already on it because we don't hear what happens behind the scenes in terms of the direct threats against them. So they're actually hyper aware of their risks to those individuals. So I think you might be surprised in that industry how much risk there is. And I think they're ahead of the game as it relates to keeping those, they call them high value clients, safe. So those people are already taken care of for the most part. It's the average Joe citizen that is complacent and doesn't think that it could happen to them. That's really the higher risk individual and the ones that, really need to be thinking more about this and be more aware and just start being prepared for it. But that other aspect is already taken care of. And as I said, we do business on both ends. So I can say that with a fair amount of confidence.
The interesting thing is like the average Joe, right, is the sheer speed of this now as well, right? So we've got a podcast. We've been building this for about 4 years. We got, on average, about an audience of around 4,000 people. I could say something right now and publish it tomorrow, and those 4,000 people within the next week will listen to it, and it could be extremely controversial. And I don't think it would be very hard to find out where I live. I don't think it would be very, very hard. So I could literally go to like public enemy number one tomorrow just from one thing I say. You know, it doesn't take much to go like viral on the internet nowadays, particularly if it's something bad. So I think the sheer speed of how much this can change now is that an employee, a journalist, anyone really, a kind of low-level MP can go from, you know, unheard of to the biggest thing in news from one tweet overnight.
It is shocking, and you're right. And that influence, that exposure to having them have that platform can come from anywhere. Absolutely.
It just takes that one tweet. And it's that, I think that is what makes this really hard now. Because you'd be like, well, hang on a minute, James, you want me to roll out loads of expensive lone worker tech to all of the MPs in the UK, even these ones down here in bloody Kettering and Wellingborough or whatever, that no one's ever really heard of. Well yeah, because it just takes one tweet from that person.
And yes. Exactly. That is exactly the case. Here in Canada, the federal MPs, members of parliament, they are all currently provided with the opportunity to have panic buttons. Mm-hmm. And I believe it's just happening at a provincial level here as well. So even in Canada, this has been identified as a major need.
Yeah. Wow.
Where we're friendly.
Yeah. And you're really nice to each other. Where over here, we just hate each other. So that doesn't make. I would be curious to see if that conversation is happening in the UK. I find the UK's quite attitude towards safety seems to be quite, we discount the future quite a lot. I find in our culture is very, it won't happen to us kind of thing. When we see these cases of, you know, Sir David and Joe, who had been victim to these horrific events, I think a lot of the time we think, oh, bloody hell, that's a crazy case, that you wouldn't see that again in your lifetime. Whereas, like, you know, I googled it thinking about Joe, and I completely forgot about Sir David as well. So it's like it is happening, and I think the pace of change now that we have that social media is driving. Again, I think there's good things to social media and bad things, like anything, but the sheer pace of it, I would be really interested to see if government, I don't know, I don't even know who employs MPs. I think it would technically be the parliament, but I'm not really sure, like,
yeah,
who is the duty holder.
They're members of parliament, yeah.
Yeah, so, like, if I'm a member of parliament for the Labour Party, is my employer the Labour Party? I don't know. Anyway, so whoever's that duty holder of that, are they having these conversations? I'm going to stab a guess and say they're not over here, but I'm
glad. That would be shocking, you know, because I find the UK is actually ahead of North America as it relates to lone worker policy, lone worker technology, for sure leaders in the industry from that perspective. I'd say Canada next, followed distantly by the United States. So I would be surprised. It would be disappointing. And if they don't have anything in place, they should be talking to us. So if there's anybody listening, you should be talking to Solskjaer. Just saying.
I think the other thing I think is quite interesting is the media. We've spoke about journalists quite a lot, but I think typically, again, you've got a similar challenge here in that you have the big papers, which I think would be an easy conversation, right? To be like, okay, you're going to be a journalist and I want you going to have a look at this really complex, maybe, you know, challenging environment. We're going to risk assess and emergency plan the shit out of that. I think that makes sense. But where is the line when it comes to the Evening Telegraph round here, which is like small time, you know, newspaper, mostly covering Sheila who lost her cat or whatever, but like small time stories, but ultimately could still end up in quite a tense conversation one-on-one with somebody in their house. And you just never know. I think back to like my short time in the care sector where we were going in people's flats It was quite rare that you went, that the safety team went into somebody's flat, but ultimately our engineers did. And then to come back to your original point, they're the normal people we think of when we think of lone working, right? But I'm not sure we would have thought of, say, like, if I worked for the Evening Telegraph, I wonder if the Evening Telegraph are going, actually, yeah, I know we're sending Bob to talk to Sheila about how she just got a letter from the Queen because she's 100 or whatever. But what we don't know is that her husband is got severe mental health issues and could quite easily become violent. We've no idea when you go into someone's house what's there, even if it's a dog or whatever. It makes me wonder when people start having that conversation, and ultimately I do think kind of funding and costs and stuff start to come in. Those things are operating on such a tight margin, you know, there's no money in small local papers anymore, where that funding's coming from and stuff. So it does start to get really complicated.
Yeah, for sure. And like anything, whether it's what we offer or other types of PPE or anything like that, you have to weigh it out, right? The risk and the cost. And I totally get it. And it's not necessarily for everyone all of the time, for sure not. So organizations, I think their first step, though, is to do the risk assessment. What is the likelihood that something's going to happen? And not look at it with rose-colored glasses, but look at it from the perspective that if there's a likelihood. So what is the likelihood that it's going to happen? What type of industry you're in? And the ones, especially the industries that have never really thought of it or looked at it before, maybe now is the time to think about it and try to get ahead of an incident instead of being that one behind. Because as an organization, if you haven't done anything and a major incident happens, the whole world's going to know about it. So where do you want to be as an organization? Do you want to at least have had the conversation and maybe looked at that level of risk and done something about it? Because I guarantee it to you that if they do something about it ahead of time and have those protocol procedures and technology in place, it's going to be less costly than if they do nothing and react to it.
Mm. Yeah. I think it's the likelihood bit that's going to keep tripping us. So I think in that conversation, I think even in normal safety, like working at height, we're not very good at that. We go, what's the risk? Well, if you fall off or here, you're dead. But I've been doing this for 50 years and I've never fell off. And it's like, that's such a terrible way for us to have this conversation. And so how it's interesting, it's like, how do we have that conversation? Do we go, right, as a politician, James, you're a bit more of a controversial politician. So we're going to give you this panic button, or we've only got 10, for example, or we're going to try and risk base this. So we'll give it to you because you're a bit more controversial or whatever. But ultimately, controversy is a perception, isn't it? So I might not be quite controversial, but to someone who agrees with the other person, I am quite controversial. If I'm very on the fence, that might be equally as infuriating to somebody. So I think it's that likelihood thing that's going to make this really hard for those journalism type, politician type industries where the speed, the prediction, likelihood, all of that stuff is just nigh on impossible to guess, I think. I think it comes down to what you just said, is that if something goes wrong as a company, how do we want to be perceived?
Yeah. And even if you look at the federal government of Canada, they have offered this technology to all of the MPs. Now, whether or not those MPs choose to, first of all, take them up on it and take one and then wear them. I mean, there's only so much that you can do. We have a saying here in Canada, I don't know if you have it, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. So it really, that as an organization, you do what you can to keep your at-risk workers safe. You've done your bit, and then it's up to them to be able to, you know, take it the rest of the way.
I mean, I would kind of go retreading water, but like the more I think of it, the more I just think, do you know what? This just opens up such a massive, and I think for the big companies, you know, like BBC, I think some of the members of the BBC safety team listen to this, actually, based off some people that talk to us. So it'd be curious to get some of them on maybe, but like, even if you're just like, right, okay, we're just going to send some journalists and, you know, we think about journalists of like, right, there's a problem. What do we do with a journo? We send them towards the problem because everybody exactly. wants to know what's going on.
And that is exactly it.
And it's just so funny, isn't it? Where you got, okay, yeah, emergency services, yeah, we're gonna proper look after them because they're going into the fire. So is a journalist. Like, maybe they're not going into the fire, but they're right there. And even in the middle of a storm, a flooding, whatever, you know, sensitive political situations, journalism is right there.
One of our customers, actually a number of our customers, in particular in the province of Ontario, are ambulance drivers. They outfit all their ambulance drivers because of that. They're the first ones that are being sent into these very risky areas. And they have no particular way. They have radios and things like that. But if as you can imagine, when they're doing their job, how do they call for help? And yet they're the first people that we throw into the fire. It's very interesting how we outfit a police officer. We make, you know, ensure that they're okay. But all these other people that are also first responders aren't adequately equipped to stay safe.
Yeah, I've had that conversation in the past, but with the fire service, where the fire service have purposely been called into like a cul-de-sac, essentially like a trap, where they've literally been called into a trap. Where there's a little fire, in they go, and then they just get stuff thrown at them, and they're just stuck in the fire appliance, just stuff thrown at them, in quite scary, potentially could have escalated into something a lot more serious. And that's where we come back to what we were talking about earlier, is that when we start seeing these roles, these jobs, not as people, but as characters, as we see the badge or the uniform, we don't see the person in it. So we might be throwing stones at the government in the subconscious of our head, but actually what we're doing is throwing stones at a person.
Absolutely.
It is fascinating when you really think about it, isn't it? It's just, and I think part of it as well, maybe, is that if you were to use that fire service ambulance type scenario, is the sheer level and complexity of what they face as the day-to-day job, you can become quite over consumed by those big risks, can't you? Like, well, yeah, we're going to focus on a fire because we're going to send these guys and girls into a fire, so we need to sort that out. And probably just completely just forget the potential of something like this, the societal issues. It's kind of a big minefield when you start to open it up. And I remember the first time we started, and I thought, we've covered lone working on a podcast before. I'm curious as to where this would go. When you said, I actually like to have a conversation more about different types of profession that we don't really think about. I was like, that's a good point, because I've never thought about it myself either. And I think most people, if you're in those industries and I know actually the guy who's a head of safety for Leicester Fire Service, I'd have to ask him if they still experience any types of aggression like that. But if you're in those industries, maybe you do think about it. But typically, when we do think about lone working, we do think about those trades and stuff. I don't think many of us would consider journalism or politicians as a kind of lone worker risk,
because the first thing you think about is lone, and you're like, well, they're not really alone because they're always around people.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's part of the danger of the terminology of lone worker, is there's this preconceived notion of what it is and who it is and who requires it, and it's like we've checked off all those boxes. But we need to reframe it, which is why I keep saying at risk, as you have as well, because who are the people that are at risk, and who are the ones that need something to keep them safe? And so that we don't just automatically default to those trades, as you said.
And interestingly, like thinking of it a bit more, not just on the roles as well. So I think in my career, and I worked in housing post Grenfell, and one of the roles that I was given was going round to our medium to high rise properties and essentially listening to the residents and trying to, well, I'll tell you the word I was told by my bosses, reassure them. The response from me was, but what if they're in a building that's shit? And then you can guess where that conversation went. And so my job was to go around and reassure them I'm navigating a minefield here, as you can probably work out, but to go and reassure people. And typically the conversations were quite good. Most of the time people were more bothered about the dog poo on the front lawn or when they're going to sort the fence out. They surprisingly, like, we thought we were going to get lynched. And I only really had about two or three really difficult conversations, but ultimately no real problems. But thinking about it, we had a mass rollout of these lone worker devices. And naturally, our national safety manager had pretty much just said, look, we've got these ones. They were quite clever, actually. They were the ones that we ended up with in the end were like part of your lanyard badge. So you had your name badge on your lanyard, but it was also that was also like your panic button tracker thing. So that was quite good. Now, I don't think the safety team had them, thinking back on it. I'm trying to work out in my head whether we did, but I don't think the safety team had those because typically we weren't in a difficult situation. Mister, that's enough. We weren't in those difficult situations, but you're now sending us a safety professional to go talk about a very sensitive topic and trying to talk about that topic post Grenfell when they're in a situation that echoes similarities of Grenfell.
Mm-hmm.
So overnight, my role's gone from not even considered as a risk to like, well, actually, I could be in a really tense conversation here with somebody now.
Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating.
Yeah. And you know, there's always tense conversations, but if you can have a person-to-person conversation where they're seeing you as a person and you're able to address that and you're dealing with somebody who is reasonable and rational, then great. You know, they are not great, but okay, that's a reality of difficult conversations and we need to have them. It's when those variables change. It's when, as you said before, you're not seen as a person, but you're seen as a character. You are the fill in the blank, whatever you are. When you're seen as this anonymous individual, that's a problem. When the person that you're talking to or dealing with is struggling with some major mental health issues, that's a problem. When, you know, you're dealing with a crowd of really angry people, that now we're talking crowd behavior and you're not talking individual behavior, that's a problem. And so it's when those variables change that's when we need to be concerned.
Yeah. Thinking a bit more holistically, like not just about the role, but ultimately what is that role in that situation? How might that be interpreted by the person that you're interacting with and so on?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow. Awesome. Cerise, thank you very much for your time. I don't want to take too much of your day because you've still got a day ahead of you in Canada. If people are interested in SolidGuard, what's the best way to kind of move it forward, find out more about you guys and so on?
Absolutely. Just go to our website, www.solusguard.com, SolusGuard. SolusGuard.com.
And we'll put that website in the description as well for everybody. So that makes it nice and easy. But thank you very much, Cerise, for your time. It's been an interesting conversation.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Okay, peeps, hope you enjoyed that episode. All the links for Cerise's company, if you want to find out some more, you want to talk to them, whatever it is, all the links will be in the description below. If you need some help with managing the risk of lone worker or any other safety-related, fire-related or kind of human behavioural type related stuff around safety, then check out riskfluentltd.com and maybe you can work with us, maybe we can work with you. All the links and stuff we mentioned in the description below. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I'll catch you next week. Safe.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the host and its guest and do not necessarily reflect the position of the companies. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are examples only based on limited and dated open source information and should not be utilised in real life as the only solution available. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the companies. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, or otherwise, without prior written permission from James McPherson.